The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights.
Welcome back to the Car Dealer Podcast, where we pick our favorite stories of the week and ask an industry guest to choose which were the best. I'm John Ray, and joining me for our first podcast of the new year, it's the AI-powered businessman, James Baggett. James, how are you?
This is AI talking now, so you can ask this any question you want, and I will respond.
What's the capital of Peru?
You've stumbled AI already. It's actually me. Lovely to see you, John. You're not feeling very well, are you? So thank you very much for making sure that you are here at the podcast. So
Wouldn't miss one. If you hear any retching, don't be alarmed. Carry on. And also at the same time, and I'm in your house, and there's a man installing a charge point in the wall, isn't there?
Yes.
So there's a nice.
No, he's finished that now. He's just doing. He's powering it up to the internet. Good luck with that in this old property.
Right. Okay.
Oh dear. Well, nice to see you, John. I know we've had an interesting start to the new year, haven't we? I mean, I don't know about you, but I came back and I'd completely forgotten how to do everything, including typing. It wasn't quite as bad as one of the guys at the local newspaper that I work with who came back actually the next day after work and forgot his password for his computer. And his password was password. So, I mean, it wasn't quite as bad as that for me, but I have struggled to do all forms of typing this week.
That's not Dave Brown you're talking about, is it?
No, it's not Dave Brown. It's not Dave Brown. But they will remain nameless. But no, I've had a brilliant start to the working week. I was off on holiday last week, but this week we've had a little road trip, haven't we? We've been out to see a used car dealer on Monday, and then we spent the day with Auto Trader on Tuesday, which was absolutely fascinating. And we've eaten at some fantastic establishments, mostly meat, which might explain, John, why you're not feeling very well.
Yeah, might have overstaked it slightly. But yes,
I won't talk about Auto Trader, didn't we?
We had a good old meeting with Auto Trader, didn't we? Which, of course, we will be... Well, this is the time to mention it. I was going to say we'll be talking about it in our next video, but actually we won't be. We said we'd talk about it in the podcast. So here we are.
No, it was a meeting, actually, and it was mostly about integrating me as a new dealer on the platform, because I'm now set up. I have sold my first car. The smart car was advertised on Christmas Eve, and I sold it on Sunday to the second lead that I got from Auto Trader, and the first person who actually came and test drove it. Lovely 60-year-old lady who wanted an automatic rather than the manual Citroen DS3 that she was driving around in. She came along, she's bought it, sent me a deposit on Monday, and I'm delivering it to her house in a week on Sunday. So I bought that car on a bit of a whim, really, from a party exchange deal. Got a very good deal on it. I made decent margin on it. When I looked at the Auto Trader retail rating on it, it had a very high retail rating of 89. And I didn't really know what that meant until this week. And now, having seen how that data is generated, on how that figure is, that they get to that figure, and also what the market health means for my area, and all the stuff that we've written about for years, really, but never quite understood, I can understand why that car sold so quickly. And I said to them, well, you know, I want more of those. You know, what do I go and buy? And they've sort of given me some advice on how to do that. And we've worked on that, John, haven't we, this week, and bought another couple of cars that are sort of, we think, of the same ilk. But it'd be interesting to see whether that data actually proves to, we see it prove to be a quick sale. So yeah, and I really found that day interesting. I don't know about you. I mean, I was asking loads of questions, but did you find it as interesting as me?
I did find it interesting. Yeah, I mean, yeah, we threw the schedule out with your amount of questions, actually, didn't we? But they laid on a full day, didn't they? So we heard from the sort of AI engineering-y teams that power all this retailer rating, because not retailer rating, what's it called? Retail rating. This little score out of 100 is generated by various different AI models, isn't it? They were saying it goes off and works out. It's things like how popular it is in search, how popular it is in your particular area, how quickly it sells, how much, I can't remember all the other things that went into it, but there's a lot of stuff went into it, and they've done that over 10 years, haven't they? So we heard from them. We heard from a slightly terrifying lady, not
Yes.
terrifying in person, not personality wise terrifying, but she had a lot of terrifying things to tell you about how you could do everything completely wrong and have trading standards shut you down,
Yes.
or people who could come and scam you out of your car by
That was the
switching the
thing that was
keys
more
around.
scary. That was the
Yeah.
thing that was more scary, I think. I mean, I get all the things I can do wrong, and I've ginned up on a lot of that, but it was the I hadn't in any way thought about people coming to steal the cars and scam me and do the key swap and all of these things that she was saying. I was thinking, oh, actually, I really need to think about this. I'm John. I'm very conscious that we've got a
Yes.
fantastic guest, and he's
Yes.
probably got loads of interesting insight into all these things we've talked about. So maybe we should introduce him and ask him these
Yes.
questions.
Our guest this week is former Imperial Cars director, now automotive consultant, Neil Smith. Neil, lovely to speak to you as always.
Oh, and but yeah, exactly the same back at you guys. Always good to catch up, and I'm sure there's lots of interesting stuff to talk about.
Yeah, lots. Neil, listening to what we were
Yep.
talking about there with the kind of using the Auto Trader data to like seeing what it meant when it came to selling that first car and trying to deploy it when it came to buying my next cars, which John and I really tried to do. I'm pretty sure we caught up before Christmas, and you were really into this sort of stuff, weren't you, at Imperial? Perhaps can
Oh,
you
yeah.
just give us a little bit of an insight into how you were doing it then and those people listening?
Yeah, so back probably around to, so before it was retail rating, they used to have a desirability factor, which was like a star rating, 1 to 5. And it gave you an indication of how that car might perform in certain regions based on historic data, based on trend analysis, and based on looking at how that stock was moving through the market. So we started to use that data, I would say back in 2017, to massively inform our buying strategy. So we took all of that data in via API into our backend systems. So we developed all our own backend systems in the end, because there was nothing out there at the time that would do this. And it enabled us to not only, we had a particular profile of stock, similar to what you're saying right now, James. You've now found that this smart car is a car that you really want to try and find some more of now, because you've turned that car, with by the sounds of it, within 14 to 20 days, which is phenomenal. You sold it to the second person that inquired. So quite rightly, you want to go and buy three or four of those now. And that's exactly the way we worked. But we were talking about buying 2,000 cars a month, not one. Okay, so we had to find a way where, and we had a buying team of seven at the time. So we had seven buyers who were buying 300 to 350 cars a month to keep our stock levels where they needed to be. And clearly, you can't do that with the finger in the air attitude to, oh, that looks quite good, I'll buy that. So the Auto Trader data was massively important, and we used it to narrow down the stock we wanted to look at. So at the time, we were feeding between 7,000 and 10,000 cars that were available through trade disposal channels into our system a day. We had algorithms that brought that down to potentially the 500 cars that we wanted to buy based on our profile stock and the mix, stock mix, and what we knew as well would sell well at that time. And we then overlaid that with retail metrics data, or desirability back in the day. And that then enabled us also, on certain cars, there would be cars, data's not infallible. So we always had a sort of oversight, and there'd be cars that might have a low retail rating, but we knew for whatever reason we did all right out of. And if it's low retail rating, sometimes you can get those a little bit cheaper as well, because people won't bid up as far on those. So we overlaid our own data on that and had a view on it. But essentially, and I'm working with dealers now who are trying to source nothing other than 60 plus retail rating, because You know, why go and buy something that's why experiment with something that's a 9 retail rating? What's the point? You know, there's no point. So essentially, working with that, we then also used market value retail back to buy these cars. So we used the Auto Trader market value. We didn't really at that point. The only reason we were using CAT, this was 5-6 years ago, was to compare across supply disposal channels and see how we compared across that. But we worked everything back from retail rating and from market value, and we would apply our entry price into Auto Trader. If it was a 80 to 100 retail rating, we'd probably start at 100% of market value, 101. If it was a 20 to 30, because we've got stitched up with one in part exchange, then we might be looking at entering market at 97, because we knew we had to put that out there very competitively to still turn it quickly. And it started to dictate the profitability, started to dictate everything. So we got to the point where we automated that, and there are tools out there now that do that. Not as well as we were doing it, because we were able to bespoke and refine, etc. But there are tools out there that help retailers now make those decisions a lot easier. But you'd also be surprised, James, in the amount of people who aren't using that data even today. And that data essentially is pretty much free.
Well, yeah, I mean, for me, I don't know where to start. You know, I'm not a car dealer.
Yeah.
I've been writing about this for this industry for 20 years, but I've never actually been out there and sold these cars myself. So, you know, I've got nothing other than the data until I can have a gut feeling. So this is giving me an advantage in some ways that I can look at it completely fresh and buy things in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that it's changing the world and, you know, and cracking the code, but it's just, I'm using all of the tools I've got, and actually the Auto Trader ones are very powerful. It sounds like you were deploying them quite some time ago, doing exactly the sort of thing that we want to do.
Yeah.
My question to you would be, I mean, this is an AI car dealership project, and we're trying to deploy AI as much as possible. And, you know, my discussions with John this week were, I think AI can do a lot of that for us. I think AI could say to us, and look at all the auction catalogs and refine it with what I'm looking for, and say to us at the end, here you go, James, these are the 10 cars to go and look at. And, you know, John and I realized that when you actually look at those cars in a bit more detail, there's things that don't come up in the data, you know, the scratch, etc. The recon work that's needed. But do you think AI could be used and deployed to do this quite efficiently, or do you think that the human touch is vital?
I think that the human touch for us was vital. Really, and look, we employed individuals that had no car buying experience at all in that department towards the end, because the system put in front of them the cars to buy. The system told them what price to pay. So we would take that market value, we'd apply a percentage deduction based on retail rating. We'd then take out our initial opening margin we'd want to be advertising at. We'd take out VAT from that margin. We'd look at whether we'd be interrogating the auction data and see that it needed a service, it needed an MOT. We were, at the time, we were bringing in cosmetic line damage from the damage appraisals as well, so we could put a value on what we had a lookup table, so we could say, right, there's a scuff on a diamond cut wheel, that's going to cost us £50, £60 internally to put right, take that off. And we presented the buyer with a price. This is what you buy the car for.
Mm.
If they applied their own experience over time on that and said, well, actually, you know what, even though the system says this, I think it's worth going another £200, they had to put a comment in there, well, why have you done that? And it might well be because there was an element of spec on there that was really unique, and they knew that once they advertised that car, they were going to get that, they turn it quicker and get a bit more money for it. So that was fine. I suppose from an AI point of view, we've got to establish a little bit around machine learning. So and this was something we were dabbling with at the time in terms of putting all of that data into a machine learning program, which would then start to spit out more and more interesting information and data and insight for us to operate on. So ChatGTP, asking it, what's the best car to buy? You're probably not going to get an answer. You know, that will probably then go and scour the internet and say, well, the most popular car at the moment is this, this, and this. Does that mean it's the right car for a dealer to buy? Well, who knows? I mean, we used to buy a lot of BMWs and we used to sell a lot of BMWs, but we made very little money in them because it was such a highly competitive market. So I suppose that I'd be noting a little bit of caution at this point. However, what I would say is that that popularity piece, so where we use retail metrics really, or where we saw some value in it, was understanding what the next hot thing was. Because with the best will in the world, we can buy historically based on performance. But once we see, and for us, it was for many months, we would be buying Qashqais and A-class Mercedes because they always turned well. They generated a good finance penetration. They retained a good level of profit. So, but once what those start to tail off, where do we find the where as a retailer? So you've now found that you can smell a smart you can sell a smart car. What's the next hot thing for you? Unless you buy one and experiment, you wouldn't know that unless you look at retail rating. So when you're looking at those cars, suddenly you see a car that's retail rating 95, a make model you'd never thought of buying, it's going to turn within 20 days, you're going to give that a go. But you
Well,
would
that's
never
exactly
have
what we did.
found, yeah, exactly. You would never have found that car without using retail rating because you'd have to take a gamble.
We that's what we've had to do. We've had to do it slightly differently and just said it's like John and I were refining this list and saying, well, we want everything over a 90 retail rating because we want it to turn quickly. We want this profit margin in it roughly before we start working out the recon costs, etc. And they need to be under this value because I can't offer finance at the moment because I'm not FCA regulated. So, you know, it was like these sorts of things just help refine that list. But at the end, there was a manual process that John and I had to go through. I think that from what I can see is that AI would, once you put those parameters in and asked it to make sure it's always ch like, make sure it's got service history, make sure it's got two keys, all those sorts of things that you can miss when you're doing loads of them all over the place, it can help refine that 500,000 cars that are for sale on likes of what CarWow and Motor Trader on a daily basis down to the 10 cars that are in your buying profile. So that was the way we were trying to do it, and that's the way that we've bought these two cars this week. I bought a Skoda Citigo at 98 retail rating and the margin that I wanted, and we bought a Nissan Qashqai. Funny you mentioned those, which was very similar in terms of those in terms of those data points. So it will be interesting to see what happens. It might be completely wrong, but I've got no other way of judging it at the moment because I don't know
Well,
whether
no.
people want to buy Qashqais in my area.
No, and look, I think where I get to with dealers a lot at the moment is, you know, from the auto trader perspective, you sort of talk to them and start to I think a lot of dealers and you've gone up and had a day's training at auto trader to understand what these metrics mean. Probably a lot of the dealers that are around the sort of 50 cars on a site don't have a full appreciation of what that data means. So they just do what they've always done, you know, which is fine. And a lot of them make very good money because they're very good because they've got the experience. But taking that data in and being able to use that data to inform when you start to hit volume, you can't do it any other way. You know, you can't have a team of 30 people sitting on an auction lane, either remotely or and just making a decision as the car goes through the lane. They've got 30 seconds to look around the car and make a decision to spend 20 grand of a business's money. It just doesn't, you know, that's not going to work. So having said that, there are smaller dealers who are embracing it. And the fact is, you are advertising your car on Auto Trader. So why would you not use their data? You know, Auto Trader want to help you, irrespective of how much it is, what people think. Auto Trader want to help you sell your car quickly, want to help you as a dealer sell your car quickly. So they're giving you this data. Use it, overlay your own experience if you want, but don't discount it. It's, you know, you've got it. The data's there, available. It's
It was sort
if you haven't got, carry on.
it's sort of, sorry, I was going to say it's
That's
sort
right.
of the same with the pricing. I mean, because on the pricing side of things, now I've seen the real importance of those pricing flags. The good, you know, having your car in the green is really important. But also equally, not having your car in a in outside of that is really important too. You know, if it's overpriced, then you have to give some real reasoning as to why Auto Trader thinks it's overpriced. And equally, if it's underpriced, you don't want to put people off. You know, one of the things that they said is they find some dealers are putting their prices down outside of the green. And what that means is either buyers are put off because they think something's wrong with it, or secondly, it falls outside of those search terms. You know,
Definitely.
there are the general. So what are you seeing? Because I mean, I'm conscious that I've hijacked this a little bit as a research piece on that AI. So I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are on the current pricing and whether you think there is an opportunity for dealers at the moment to be pricing their cars a little bit more keenly. I mean, what are you seeing?
Well, obviously we've had 2 months of turmoil, October, November, 4% drop in book every month, 2%, I think it was in December. So if you look at that, we've had a 10% drop in 3 months. It's ridiculous, you know. So what does that do to the market? Well, it obviously puts it into a bit of a, it's a volatile situation. So if you were a dealer 3 months ago that had a lot of stock and then suddenly it's all taken to 10% book drop, you're in a place where you've got to dispose of that. Your point around low value cars on Auto Trader is completely right. You know, sometimes it's that, well, it's too good to be true or there's something wrong with it. And also, and we did a lot of experimentation around this falling out of search, you know, and if a consumer, and consumers are so much more, they've got so many tools at their disposal now to understand that an Audi A3, 5 years old, is typically 13 grand with 60,000 miles on it or something like that. So are they going to go and look for that car if it's at 10 and a half grand? No, they won't. Will they find it? Potentially not, because it's out of search. Is it kosher? Has it been, as the customer, has the dealer had it for 365 days and now it's making a 2 grand loss? So they've just got to get a shot of it. Does the customer know that? No, they don't. Going back to the, we would always be looking at, lower was not really an option for us. So when we started to see, and I've done some experimentation recently with dealers where they've, especially coming into Christmas and, you know, coming into those few weeks up to Christmas, obviously we always see a slowdown in churn at that point. And I had dealers then saying, and one particular, and we said, you know what, we've got a little bit of overage here that's at 92, 91, 90% of Auto Trader. We're getting nothing on it. Just shove it all back up to 97% and see what happens, you know? So let's reset almost, because what's the worst that can happen? You get a lead on it and you have to give them a discount of 500 quid while you're in a good place, because you were going to sell it for grand less anyway. So there's a, and sometimes, James, back in the day, we used to put cars up. Because we started to see, and so we started to operate like an airline. So well, once once you start to see that, so we were always told if you start to see a spike in views on a particular car, it's usually because somebody's revisiting that car more often because they're really getting interest in it. So we experimented and said, right, let's put that one up 200 quid. Now, what that tended to do sometimes was you'd get a call from the potential customer who'd been watching it going, well, I was going to come in and buy that, and you just put it up 200 quid. And we'd say, right, come in today, and we'll honor the original price. So you can play with these things, and it's almost...
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's almost like, it's like a, you know, it's like being an investor in the city. You know, you're playing with these numbers all the time. When you've got that volume, and you're also working to incredibly skinny margins on the metal because you're in that competitive space, you want all of these little, you want to be experimenting. You want to try putting some cars up. And if they are that unique or they are that sought after and you've got a really good retail rating on that car and you start to see that interest, then yeah, tickle it up a bit and see what happens.
It's funny you should mention airlines because Becca this week has been booking flights and she said, you know, I need to book them now because they keep on going up. And that made me think, hang on a minute, like we are so used to it in other markets.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're used to it with airlines. You know, that, you know, what surely that ticket price, if it's for that airline, has got one price, but they're just trying to make as much as they can for that seat. And it has to be the same with cars. But what it did make me think is, how would customers react to that? And you've sort of answered the question there. But, you know, if customers suddenly see that these prices are fluctuating, you know, how will they react? Did you do it to the point where you were making daily adjustments to cars?
Oh, yeah. Daily adjustments. Some of that was automated. So we had, within our pricing system, we had different ways of automating price changes. So we could track market value. So an example, we bring a car in, it's a retail rating of 18. We set our entry level at 97%. We'd set the system to hold that for 2 weeks, build a bit of traction. We would then say week two to week three, just now track market value. So if market value drops by 5%, drop our price by 5%. Now we're in the week four. Let's go 1.5% market value, below market value. If we see, and we used to pull in the advert metrics as well. So if we see more views of the advert tomorrow, then put 50 quid on it, you know, so we could manage it and still track market value and make sure that we were always priced competitively or just below competitively in market, giving us the best opportunity at any time to sell that car.
So my question to you is, did it work?
Yeah, we sold volume. Did it make us incredibly profitable? No. Did we make losses? No. We developed a sustainable business. But when you're in that end of the market, would I want to be doing that now, James? No, because it's so incredibly volatile in there, in that market space at the moment. I'm quite happy going and helping dealers right now who need to find other ways to generate profit or move stock quickly and bring some of that experience to it. But would I want to be in that space? When we've seen what's happened to some of the big supermarkets over the last year, yeah, in terms of massive drops in profit, and a lot of that will be down to market conditions. A lot of that will be down to potentially not reacting quick enough to these significant price drops. And that's, again, something that, you know, Auto Trader will probably have said to you, you know, you've got to be on your stock every day pricing. And when you've got one or two cars as an individual, that's achievable. If you're, and there's a couple of dealers I'll deal with that around sort of 230, 240 cars in stock. I'll go, you know, initial visit will be, oh yeah, we'll look at sort of half our stock one week and we'll look half of it the next week. Well, it's too little. Yeah. It's too little, too late. And there are ways to manage that a lot better. There's some third party products that suck in the Auto Trader data via API. And then daily you go in there and it spits out, right, you need to look at these 10 cars, these 20 cars, because they've all just dropped below what you've set as your pricing strategy for Auto Trader, and markets moved here, and now the retail metrics have dropped on this one. And so it's controllable. It's having the mindset, I suppose, that, yeah, it's velocity pricing strategy. That's it. You sell, you drive that product with your pricing to optimize it daily.
My final question to you on this is this deployable? I mean, you were doing it on a large scale in a car supermarket, yeah, group, but is this deployable to dealers of all shapes and sizes who are listening to this? You know, people like me selling a few cars to those ones who've got 10, 15 cars in stock, 50, 100. Can, yeah, everybody do it? And should everybody,
yes,
be doing it?
Yes, to the first one. There's certainly two products out there that Auto Trader partner with that will help interpret the Auto Trader better the Auto Trader data in a more visual, maybe a better way, and actually sort of suggest what needs to be done next in terms of your pricing strategy and where you want to go. And that will work on a dynamic basis daily. So there are tools out there, and these tools really are competitively priced. You know, you're talking 299 quid a month. Mm. Now, as a retailer who's trying to retail 50 cars with a turnover of, I don't know, 7-8 million, that is not a lot of money to spend on something that really gets you into that space and means you're optimizing your price. Should every dealer do it? If you're if it's a lifestyle business and you're selling 30 cars a month and you're able to be across all those cars physically, you know what you're doing, you know what stock you buy, you've got your repeat customers and you make good profit, then no. You know, that's why go and go down that route. But certainly, startup like yourself, you know, let's look at somebody who thinks, oh, I'm going to go and sell cars. Right, okay, I've never done it before. Right, get these tools. Yeah. You're doing it. You're doing it because you need to do it. If you're a dealer that's struggling at the moment, if you don't know what to do about your pricing strategy, if you're in a place where your stock is not moving and turning as it should do, the majority of the time, you don't achieve your churn because you're not on top of your pricing. That's it. Yeah. So, yes, if you've got a want to accelerate, or you're currently in a place where you're not achieving what we want to achieve, that this could incrementally improve it. But if you're having a lovely life and you're selling a few cars and making some nice profit, then what's the point?
Yeah. We'll be right back. The Car Dealer Podcast is sponsored by SalesLink from Jato, a market insight tool that's purpose-built for franchise car dealers. Get analysis on thousands of new vehicle transactions every month from all the major brands. See model mix and trim data for the brands you sell, as well as competitor data, all in the free web-based platform. It lets you track vehicle option uptake, color preferences, and gives detailed data on pricing and discounts. Sign up for your free SalesLink account today. Visit jato.com/saleslink to start unlocking your market insights. Neil, thank you very much for your insights, as always.
That's right.
Incredibly fascinating, but we do need to do some stories, John, don't we?
Yes,
we do. So James and I are going to run through our favourite stories of the week, and at the end, Neil gets to decide whose stories were the best and who is the winner. I won last time, but because I've had a few, well, one, because I'm ill, and two, because I'm feeling sorry for James, because I've had about three in a row. James can go first. Knock yourself out.
Thank you. Thank you for your pity. That's very, very kind of you. I think we're going to sort of cover a two-week period, aren't we? Because we started really in earnest. Well, I didn't. The team did. Just after New Year. So I'm going to sort of pick stories from the last 2 weeks. But I'm going to start with one from this week. And that is news that used car dealer Cinch lost some money last year, John. And I'm not sure whether you know the figure, but do you want to have a guess? Looking at your stories?
I don't have it off the top of my head. I do have it in a tab here somewhere.
Of course you do.
I'm sure it's not a lot of money.
It depends which way you look at it. It depends whether you're Alex Chesterman or not. But it's £181 million, John, is what they lost in 2023. So these are the results to the end of April 23. So they don't take into account those big book value drops that we've had in October, September, December, which I'm sure has been rather painful. But they did see an increase in, I mean, there is some good news in here. They did see an increase in revenue at the business during that financial year to the end of April last year, up 24% to £1 billion. And actually, yes, the headline of this story was the loss, 181 million, is a huge sum of money. And when you add it to the 126.8 million they lost year before, I think they probably are feeling that. However, £1 billion worth of revenue for an online only used car dealer, I think, is actually quite impressive because, you know, we did say that nobody really knew, did they, how many people wanted to buy used cars online. And I think, you know, that can be seen that there are a large portion of people out there who do want to buy in this convenient fashion. So, yes, they lost a lot of money. And the detail of that is not quite forthcoming in their accounts. Cinch say those losses were made up as it, their quotes, continue to invest in marketing, innovation, systems and personnel, and that it was aiming for long-term growth. So read into that what you will. It doesn't quite explain to me why that cost them 181 million, but still, that is it's a large sum of money to lose. But yeah, I did think it's just there was some positives there. You know, £1 billion worth of revenue is a lot of money. And because we had Neil on and playing to my audience, I did obviously want to ask Neil some questions on this. Neil, you've got experience with Cazoo. Imperial was sold to, it was sold to Cazoo. There will be people saying that there'll be lots of people listening to this. Nobody ever wants to buy used cars online. Is this proof that actually people do?
Yes. And look, I've probably over the my time since exiting Cazoo, I've probably made some comments around the fact that actually the model employed by both Cazoo and Cinch is a model that a percentage of consumers like. Okay. So, and even if we go back to, if we go back and talk a little bit about Auto Trader and the analysis they've done on car buyers, and probably 3 or 4 years ago, they came up with categories of car buyers. They were proactive showroom visitors, reluctant showroom visitors, and digital adopters. And very much as we go through year on year, so the proactive showroom visitors are those visitors who like the experience of going to the showroom. They might find the car on Auto Trader, or they might not even contact the dealer, but just turn up and have a look at it. They want to do everything. They want to touch and feel. And probably older generations still are happy doing that because they're confident in that. You've got the reluctant showroom visitors who will do a lot more online, might get their finance application approved. They might want to get a guaranteed parts exchange valuation via a remote assessment tool. But ultimately, they still want to go to the dealership. They still want to test drive the car. They want to touch and feel it, understand a little bit about the dealership and make sure they're confident to buy from there. And then you've got digital adopters, and they are very confident. And they don't want to be wasting time going around to the showrooms. They want to be able to sit at home, do everything in a couple of hours online and have the car delivered to them. Because that's for them, that's how they do things. And over these years, we see the proactive showroom visitors move more into reluctant showroom visitors. And some of those reluctant showroom visitors move more into digital adopters, primarily because the likes of Cinch and what Cazoo did in the first couple of years put so much into that trust piece and the confidence piece and the money, 14-day back money guarantee, whether you like it or not, nothing to do with the quality of the car. And they spent tens, hundreds of millions on marketing, hence what Cinch have said in their statement there that, you know, it's continued investment in marketing, that people are now confident buying cars that way. So to your original point, James, I'm probably thinking, and I haven't looked at the accounts, but I'm anticipating Cazoo will probably have done 60,000 to 70,000 units last year, since maybe a few more. So for 150,000 people to buy a car online from two relatively new entrants into the market, we're talking 3 to 4 years, that's phenomenal growth. There's been no dealer group that's grown at that rate.
They don't actually say how many cars they've sold at Cinch compared to Cazoo. I mean, Cazoo are a lot more open because they're on the stock market.
Yes.
I mean, my question on this would be, why have they lost so much money? They're not spending 151 million on marketing, are they? I mean, I know they're spending a lot, but not. I mean, how much does Ryland really cost?
Wow, yeah.
180 million.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at, I suppose, marketing budgets will be between 60 and 100 million a year.
Right.
But that's not the reason for the loss. You know, that's, I think the problem is it's a model that costs a lot to run.
Will it ever be profitable then? Will they ever be profitable, these businesses?
There's going to be a tipping point where it will become profitable. And as they develop and make parts of those businesses more and more efficient, then obviously they'll be, you know, they've got to look at that cost element. The marketing spend should now start to decrease, you know, from, you know, what Cazoo had to do due to the issues there was cut marketing spend pretty much out of that loop completely, all the sponsorship stuff. But they built a base that allows them to still sell cars. And I would anticipate that Cinch maybe this year, next year, will start to really reduce that marketing spend because they built that brand awareness. And people know they can go online and buy a car from them. And that's the point where they start to come to maybe a break-even piece, you know, volume, scale, reduction in some of those costs. And it's been a hard lesson for both of those businesses. It's a hard learning, you know. And I would have thought Cinch, and I think probably you and I quite a while ago would have had a discussion around this, Cinch would have been the best positioned having every other part of that automotive process around them, wrapped around them to manage that. You know, if you look at what Cazoo did, they came into a marketplace they knew very little about and had to go and buy all of those services. And initially they were buying those services from BCA and preparation and various other bits. So I would have anticipated Cinch moving forward, I anticipate Cinch has got a potential to get the break even. Cazoo again, you know, they've done a lot of cost cutting, as we know, over the last year, to get themselves to a point where they're positive GP. So, yeah, if they can get through these years of losses and they can support them, a couple of years' time, potentially they'll move into a profit-making situation.
I mean, quite a gamble. And I mean, we've certainly seen it with Cazoo, haven't we? I mean, they're now desperately trying to get more money in. But right, yep. John, I'll tell you what, let's leave the used car online disruptors for one moment. I'll let you move us on.
Okay. Are you describing yourself as an online used car disruptor as well?
I'm definitely not, no. No.
Okay, good. Well, I will just move us into the ZEV mandate. which as of last week kicked in at a higher percentage. So as of January the 3rd, 22% of new cars to be sold by car makers have to be zero emission. And for vans, it's 10%. So vans aren't unaffected by this either. So what we are presumably going to start seeing now is the sudden ramp up of push of EV that we talked about last year. And I mean, to an extent, I mean, we've been driving around the country listening to various terrible radio stations, haven't we, James? And there's been a little bit of radio advertising of some suspiciously good deals on electric cars from a lot of manufacturers. We've heard a lot of 0% finance offers, which this day and age is basically giving away free money, isn't it? We've heard quite a few things along those lines. So my question is, who is going to start suffering from this? Because some manufacturers, a lot of manufacturers, are not in a terrible position for this. And even they are evidently struggling. If you look at Mercedes, that's where you see some ridiculous offers. I think it was $7,500 off an EQC or something, wasn't it? We mentioned
that.
And it was a similar sort of radio ad we heard. But they are a company that has got a very strong EV, strong mix of EV across their range. It's people like Toyota where I'm looking and thinking they are not going to shift. There's no way they're going to do 20%, 22% EV sales when they've got one EV. And as EVs go, it's not all that brilliant either.
Or Ford. I mean, Ford will really struggle. I mean, and actually at the same time, you know, although those Toyota, Ford are very strong brands, it comes at a time when retail buyers don't want EVs. You know, we are further away from that 2030 ban than we ever were. It's 2035 now, isn't it? So it's a big distance away, and people just think, I don't need to do it. So I think at this time, this is going to be the hardest year, I think, for selling EVs. And the only way they're going to be able to do it is pulling the price lever, term we've heard many times this week, isn't it?
Well, or buying credits, or I don't know if that's...
All these brands to get consumers into new EVs is going to be very, very tough this year when they don't want them. And you're going to have to make them at price parity with ICE, or actually, dare I say it, cheaper than normal ICE cars.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other part of this puzzle is the fact that this year there's potentially six Chinese manufacturers, pure EV, coming into the market. And those products, and the reason we've seen price drops are obviously what Tesla did a few months ago, and over a period of 3 months took $15,000 out of the Tesla 3. So suddenly you've got legacy OEMs who are having to reduce the price of their cars to compete. And now we're going to have an influx of, and BYD is starting to take hold. And you've got, you know, average value on a reasonably good EV could be around the $25,000 to $30,000 mark new. But what those, obviously the likes of BYD are 100% EV. So they're going to hit their target. The ZEV target easily, but everything that BYD sells takes a unit away from Mercedes or BMW or Audi. So I think it's going to be incredibly difficult. I think the piece you sort of mentioned there around the credits, you know, Toyota, they're probably going to be they're going to have to sell their credits to a the likes of a BYD or something to be able to say, well, okay, we're, because they haven't got the production facility.
Yeah.
You know, so what are they going to do? What are some of these legacy, when I say legacy, what are the OEMs going to do, the traditional OEMs, to achieve this? Volvo are in a good place. Kia are in a good place. But there are those, like you mentioned, Ford, Toyota, that are going to struggle. There is that get-out clause of selling the credits. But even if we weren't talking ZEV, we have got that march of the Chinese coming in, and they are going to take substantial market share.
I think the other interesting point on this, I know it's slightly moving it away from your story, John, but just going back to the Auto Trader chat that we had this week about the opportunity there is with the used EV market. Although it's very, very hard to believe, they say the used EV market is in rude health. And actually, I spoke to EV experts, the award-winning dealer at the Used Car Awards, a couple of weeks ago, maybe last week. It's actually where I bought the smart car from. And they were saying they're doing very well with used EVs. There are customers out there, and it's because there is still demand out there with buyers, but so many dealers have been put off them. And what do you, Neil, with those dealers you're talking to, I mean, what's the general feeling with used EVs? Because, anecdotally, John and I ask this sort of question every time on the podcast, and most dealers say we're not touching them with a barge pole. Most used dealers say they're not touching them with a barge pole. Are you seeing the same thing when you're out there talking to people?
Think it comes down to the expertise within the dealership. So I work with a dealer group that stocks 1,000 cars. They've got 104 EVs in stock. What they have stopped doing is giving online valuations for EVs at the moment because of the volatility. They know what EVs work for them, and they understand the market quite well. You've got others who, because they don't understand the market, they are just saying, "I don't want to get involved in EVs." I was on a conversation yesterday where ex-lease Tesla, 4 years old, 60,000 miles on the clock, whatever. You're looking to be able to pick those up for sort of 20 grand now, below 20 grand. Now, those, we all know that it's a good product. It's not top, top, high-end product. It's not luxury product. But if you want something with range and technology, then that's the product to go for. So there are wins in EV to be made at the moment, but there are also models that you wouldn't want to touch. And when you start to get to the 5 to the 6 year old, you're looking at battery degradation. The WLTP figure might be 130 miles. Actually, you're lucky to get 50 out of it, especially when it's -1 degrees. So there's that element, which I think is a fear factor for a used car dealer, because when they advertise that on Auto Trader, it'll say 130 mile range. Customer takes it 45 miles out of battery. I want to return it. So there's got to be more transparency around that piece. It's like selling an ICE car with a tank of fuel that's going to do 600 miles and you only get 300 out of it because your economy is crap. So you're going to take it back and say, "What the hell's wrong?" I suppose it's a mixed bag in the used car sector. The dealer you spoke about there, who specializes in EV, that's probably why he's doing so well, because there's still a massive education piece to do with consumers because they don't know. So if they can go somewhere where there is a specialist in EV and be presented with all the different models, ranges, derivatives, blah, blah, and talk through the benefits of each, then yeah, potentially they are going to do well. But for that sort of mid-range dealer who's stocking 100 cars, I would think the maximum they'll dabble with is 5 EVs, and it'll be a sort of test and learn process.
Yeah, and when you're putting your money into them, it can feel like a bit of a gamble, I'm sure. Right, I'm going to move us on to another story, and this is it's turned into a little bit of a saga, this one, isn't it? This is news from Lookers, which
Oh, yes,
have
lookers.
lots of that. But I'm going to pick up the story that I wrote while I was on holiday, which was about the Lookers staff who are at threat of redundancy, claiming that the car dealer group was cutting corners in this process. Now, I'm not exaggerating when I say we are getting a huge number of emails, WhatsApps, LinkedIn messages, text messages, phone calls from employees from Lookers who are under threat of redundancy, who are just saying how badly they're being treated. The way I look at this is I look back at this situation. Lookers made 1,500 people redundant during the pandemic. I didn't hear from one of them. This time round, I'm hearing from lots of them. And they're saying some really, really upsetting things. I mean, some of them were saying that, like they say, the firm's cutting corners. It's the worst that they've seen the company has treated people in this situation. I must point out at this point, Lookers say these allegations were their words incorrect, but I've had a lot of these messages saying that's not the case. One person told us that the whole situation's being handled appallingly. Most of the proposals for redundancies to take place at the end of this month, but many of these staff members have not even had their individual consultations yet. We heard of roles being advertised just to certain members of staff. We heard of some jobs being made redundant and other ones similar in other dealerships not being made redundant. All these things that are very upsetting to staff. And I just think it's a very sorry state of affairs. Personally speaking, I've spoken to lots of these employees, and just the way that they've been treated and the situation that they're in at the moment. I mean, not taking into account the fact that they were told this 2 weeks before Christmas. You know, I mean, they should have. I don't know why that business didn't hold off until January. I know 2 weeks doesn't make much difference, but Christmas is a very important family time, and I really feel for these employees who were dealing with that over Christmas. I mean, and the other facets to this story is the fact that this has happened 6 weeks or so after this business was taken private in a very, very big deal. They surely knew, and they say that things, situations have changed, but surely they knew they were going to have to make 14.5% of this workforce redundant. That is a material, personally, I think that is a material change to that business. And the company that bought it would have known that they were going to do that. And off the back of this, so this story generated lots more messages. And one of them I published yesterday. I mean, you've got, this story has come about. And sorry, I'm kind of combining two stories in one here. But this story comes about because you've got a lot of disaffected staff in dealerships who are upset and worried about their jobs. So this is news that whistleblowers claiming that a Jaguar Land Rover dealership ramps are at serious risk of collapse. So this came about from whistleblowers within the company, a number of sources contacting us, Car Dealer Magazine, because they were too scared to talk to their bosses. And the reason they were too scared to talk to their bosses is because this threat of redundancy is hanging around, and they didn't want to be seen to be troublemakers. But equally, at the same time, so these ramps, there's 24 out of 26 of them at Jaguar Land Rover West London, they say are corroded so badly they pose a risk to staff. This is the problem comes at the workshop is based underground. It keeps on getting flooded with huge amounts of water that have to be pumped out. They've corroded these ramps to the point where there's some of the staff have seen people push screwdrivers through the bottom of the ramps. They're that badly corroded. But they say that their concerns are not being listened to. And they said that they had to whistleblow and tell us about this. I mean, lookers on this point said that they've had these ramps independently checked and that they've been assured that they're safe. But why are these staff coming to us? You know, why are these staff leaking these stories to Car Dealer Magazine to investigate if the business was dealing with this properly and talking to them and assuring those staff that the situation they're in is safe, then we wouldn't hear about it.
But and putting themselves at risk, you know, it's not an easy thing to do.
I just think on this front, John, just my last point is just it didn't have to be this way. You know, people who work for businesses understand they are working for a business, and sometimes things change, and sometimes, unfortunately, roles need to be made redundant. And that's happened many times over the time we've been covering this industry. But I can't say the amount of times we've been contacted where it's been so bad. I mean, the last one was Cazoo. This one has not been dealt with very well indeed. And I think the company just needs to address that. They need to address that because these staff are in very difficult situations.
I mean, we discussed, as you said there, the 1,500 made redundant previously. We had heard nothing at all. Similar story with, I think it was Peter Vardy Group made redundant.
Yeah.
Handled it in a completely different way, and I would suggest perhaps a much more sensitive way. And we've heard nothing along these lines, you know. No, and I think Peter Vardy contacted you himself, didn't he, and kind of said,
"Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
This is the situation." But this is, it's not great at all. I mean, I'm on the same emails you are. I see every day two or three emails come in, don't they?
Yeah.
From lookers employees across the whole business.
I really, really feel for the staff, and I just hope it gets sorted. And I think, you know, if I was at lookers, you know, in one of those management positions, one of those, like these new owners, I would just go out there and I would speak to the staff and tell them what's happening. You know, you go back to difficult decisions that these big companies have made, and often the CEO will address the staff and speak to them and emphasize with their situation and explain to them why they're having to make these business decisions. I don't know, Neil, what do you think? I mean, that's my opinion on this.
Look, you mentioned Cazoo in there. I mean, these situations are never going to be easy at all. And with the Cazoo acquisition of Imperial, the one thing I will say was no matter how hard that was and how difficult it was. And it was difficult for many, many people. It was done within the legal framework or the required framework. Okay. I think what you're talking about here is that, you know, there should be a 45-day consultation. Everybody should have their opportunity. If that's not being adhered to, then that's illegal. So health and safety on ramps and things like that, you know, these sort of things, there are legal frameworks in place to protect employees, protect their health and safety. I suppose with lookers as well, what we've seen over the last 4 to 5 years with lookers coming out of the really bad time for lookers when they were under investigation and various other things, that company turned itself around. It was making good profits. So this isn't a situation in my mind where a company's bought a dealer group that's in distress and therefore has to virtually asset strip that business. They bought a profitable business. So what's the mentality here?
Well, it's the funding, isn't it? I mean, they've bought this with new bank loans at ridiculous rates of interest that they're going to have to pay back, and they're clearly having to work out how they're going to do that. These loans expire in 12 months' time. Clock is ticking, and they're thinking, well, at the same time, the market's dropping slightly. What I'm saying, Neil, is they would have known that before. You know, they would have known they were going to have to pay for it.
You know. Have they not carried out their due diligence? Have they not given it the necessary foresight? We all know what happens when you take a business back to the bare bones or below, the business fails. So, you know, where is this going eventually? You can only take so much meat off the bone before you don't have a business. So, you know, are we going to see customer service levels drop? And that then becomes a spiraling loop down and down and down, because then reviews, you get bad reviews, people don't buy cars. You know, where I suppose I'd be asking, where's the foresight around ensuring that the current trading operation is maintained or improved? Mm-hmm. You know, this at the moment is 100% about cost cutting and to support, as you've said there, that funding issue. So, but you can obviously go too far, and if their revenue drops, are they then going to be able to support what they've bought into? It seems to not have been handled very well from a foresight and due diligence point of view.
No, definitely, I'd agree with you on that front. Right, enough lookers bashing, although they deserve it. Over to you, John.
I squeeze in a nice story before we end? One complete
go for it
of that almost. And it's about a Toyota dealership in, where is this? Is it in Scotland? Yes. I say that as though it's amazing there's a Toyota dealership in Scotland.
Yeah.
But it's a Toyota dealership in Scotland. It's in Helensburgh. And it's basically, it's been a long-standing Toyota dealership. Very positive reviews. Always kind of features in Toyota's top 10 or so dealerships, customer satisfaction. But the owners have decided to retire or stand down. And what they've done, rather than selling the business to someone else, is they've put it into the hands of their employees as a trust. And I just thought that was, I mean, it's kind of John Lewis-y type thing to do almost, isn't it? And they, you know, I just thought it was a really nice thing to do. They've said it felt like a natural transition. And really, it's looking after the people that have made that business a success, isn't it? It's not just going, oh, okay,
yeah,
who's the highest bidder here? Who can I sell this to? It's they want to maintain their culture, and they want to keep their staff happy, and I think that's a fantastic thing to do. And I think they're getting some sort of remuneration out of it, but it's being held in trust, and the employees will be the benefits. So I thought that was a very nice story.
Yes. Nice to see when that happens. John, can I end though? I know you just sort of were alluding to wanting to end on that story, but I've got one more, and I just thought it might be a little bit of fun. And I published last week my predictions for 2024. Mm-hmm. And I did the same thing the year before, and 6 out of my 9 predictions came true, and they weren't things like there will be a Sunday in a week, etc., etc. They were a little bit more out there than that. This year I've come up with a number of other predictions.
Hello.
Some of them are pretty Oh, some of them are pretty simple. That's right, Neil. Some of them are pretty simple. Some of them less so. But I just want to pick one of them, and then we could each do our own predictions for the year. And then when we get to the end of the year, we can see who was right. So my one, I think, out of the ones that I've written, I think Virtue will finally go private this year. I'm sure. I don't know whether how out there that is. I know there's been people sniffing around. Today, Cinch has upped their stake again in Virtue to 8%. Another increase in the amount of money they've invested there. But I actually think Virtue, by the end of this year, will be in a very similar situation to Lookers and Marshalls and be in private hands. That's my prediction I'm sticking with. John, what about you? And Neil, I'm going to ask you the same.
I've been put on the spot here.
I know.
Okay, I think let's do something around Cazoo. I think there'll be a major change to Cazoo, perhaps.
Well, my one was in the story I ended on. I think Cazoo will disappear this year. So I was a little bit bolder.
I think they might be. I think if things don't pan out and we, you know, they are in need of cash, aren't they, by the mid part of this year? I think they'll possibly be purchased and absorbed into something else. That would be my guess.
Interesting. Neil, what do you think? What's your prediction for the year?
Prediction for the year. I suppose the space I'm in is used vehicles. It's not really a prediction other than to say I still don't think in the next 12 months we're going to have stability within the used car market, and there's still going to be a lot of volatility around pricing. And we have got, well, this is now two predictions. We have got that EV piece on the horizon, and how are we going to manage that going forward? So in used, I think I'm just going to say the used market is going to be volatile for the rest of the year.
Excellent, thank you. We will revisit this at the end of the year and see who's right.
If we remember, but
that's my stories.
Brilliant. So have I got to choose now, guys?
You do. But before that, are there any stories you think we've missed this week? Well, I mean, over the last 2 weeks, really.
No, I don't think so. I think you've touched on the ones that, you know, once I get my update every day from you guys, they're the ones that I would have been looking at and would have been clicking on and going into and reading in more detail. So, no, I think you've done well.
Excellent.
That's what we like to hear. So I'm going to have to ask you, who chose the best stories? Who's your winner this week?
Although it pains me to say so, it's Mr. Baggett, because I think the Lookers story is one that we should all be keeping close to. It is... it's not a great story, and it's something that we all need to keep an eye on, really.
Thank you very much, Neil. I start the new year with a win. Lovely stuff.
A worthy win, because I know you've put a lot of hard work into those stories, James.
Well, I actually have, actually. Yeah, thank you.
Well, all that's left for me to say is thank you to Neil for judging today. Been great to have you on, as ever.
Yeah, thanks for all your advice at the start, Neil. Sorry for quizzing you. But
that's all right, James.
Much,
look,
very much appreciate
my consultancy rates are very, very reasonable.
I was going to say,
pop an invoice across later.
It's very kind, and I will ignore it.
Yeah, I wouldn't,
Thank you as well to James for not talking about his charge point, even though that was clearly the saga of 2023, getting that approved.
Well, also, John, from the last meeting, I remember we didn't mention coffee this time either, which is good.
My brain is so shot, I can't even remember what day it was yesterday.
we had a long, go and look at the last one, we had a long chat about coffee at the beginning.
I can believe it.
We do press along.
We do. Sometimes there's some car news in there. Well, we'll be back next week with another episode, so make sure you're subscribed so you can be notified when that goes live. If you want to check out the stories we mentioned today, take a look in the show notes below or head to cardealermagazine.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.